Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 67, section 2, which is old single column, page 755. All right, don't think we need very much introduction to get us spun up again. You know, you can see we just got into paper 67, where we're directly dealing with the details of Caligastian crew joining Lucifer's rebellion. You see how they expressed that fact that Caligastia didn't originate the rebellion, by the title of the first section being the Caligastia Betrayal. We saw how definitely Caligastia was, it wasn't all just nature. There was a good measure of nurture. He was very close to Lucifer. They had a similar predilection for pushing things, because they're both sort of on the far tail of the bell curve of Lenonidex. So both of them similarly had huge potentials that they could actualize that the run-of-the-mill Lenonidex wouldn't naturally do. But to him whom much is given is much expected.
Yeah, still no excuse.
And, you know, when you're given that much potential to do good, all the more you have to remember that spirit is not innately divine. Spirit is only divine in the hands of total self-control. And neither of them had the requisite self-control. They fell in love with themselves, and instead of controlling their self controlled them. And off they went on the ubiquitous, iniquitous tangent, and I say ubiquitous there because, in terms of the local system, Lucifer poured out that iniquity, at least that sophistry, upon all flesh in the local system. Everyone was uniformly bathed in it. Satan saw to it. Satan was going around spreading. Remember how, we saw that Satan came, whispered in Caligastia's ear, exactly what time to, was the go time. So the whole local system is bathed in this, and everyone has to choose, and that's why the whole local system gets instantly cut off. Everyone faced this really fundamentally supreme challenge to see through the sophistry. There really wasn't any, it wasn't like, oh, this is easy. I just go where the bright spot is shining instead of the dark spot. Like I'm trying to remind you, this darkness flooded throughout the whole local system. So you had to have the light within, because the external world went dark briefly. And so if you didn't have the enough light within, you fell into the darkness. Okay, so let's see exactly how the details roll out here on our world.
2. The outbreak of rebellion. Shortly after Satan's inspection, and when the planetary administration was on the eve of the realization of great things on Urantia, one day, midwinter, of the northern continents, Caligastia held a prolonged conference with his associate, Daligastia, after which the latter called the 10 councils of Urantia in session extraordinary. This assembly was open with the statement that Prince Caligastia was about to proclaim himself absolute sovereign of Urantia and demanded that all administrative groups abdicate by resigning all of their functions and powers into the hands of Dalagastia as trustee, pending the reorganization of the planetary government and the subsequent redistribution of these offices of administrative authority.
Maybe just a comment on just the technical details at the end there, just a little aside of it. Notice that even though this is the outbreak of rebellion, you aren't throwing all the structure out. I mean, that, remember how we read, that's the proper structure. Dalagastia oversees the 10 councils. You know, so that's all proper. Then if for some reason they needed to, you know, step aside, he would take it as, you know, as they say there, as the trustee. You know, he'd take all 10 councils under his trusteeship. And so, isn't it interesting that, you know, even a little detail like that was not thrown out the window. So that reminds you of how this rebellion is not like any of our caricatures, right? I mean, they want light and life, but they want it now, right? Like I always point out, you know, the signs that everyone chants with, right? What do we want? Fill in the blank. Well, in this case, they're filling in the blank with light and life. And when do they want it? Now. They're not just trying to destroy all the form and everything. They're going to work in it. It's just that they're going to dictate the timing of what functions within that form. And, you know, you notice not only, you know, is he going to do like he's supposed to, take trusteeship, but they're going to hand it back. You know, they're just going to have everyone retasked in a more impatient way, a hopelessly impatient way. So just, you know, little technical details like that, see, if you reflect on them, have all kinds of richness to it about what's going on. Okay, now remember, we're talking, we're going full rebellion here, but we have the full spectrum of sedition, including, what's initially seems the mildest element of sedition, sowing discontent. Okay, so you can't help but notice. Okay, one day midwinter in the northern latitudes. Huh, the winter of our discontent. It's just hilarious. Okay. Right. There it is, the winter of our discontent. And they reminded you of, again, in the very first sentence, they say shortly after Satan's inspection, and when the planetary administration was on the eve of the realization of great things on Urantia. See, it's like, oh, I can almost taste it now. Let's throw out patience and just go for it. Right? See, it just, everything conspired. You know, the fact that those 300,000 years, it was kind of slogging, but they were, it's like, oh, I can almost feel it now. It's finally going to start to go. Why wait? Let's just run with it. See, all these little elements, they're telling you because they feed in. In the darkness of midwinter, you know, he's going to claim to be the light shining in the darkness, you know, even. I mean, all these things, it's this sort of full spectrum sophistry in play.
But I imagine that this is going on all the other planets that went into rebellion pretty much around the same time, because it kind of all happened somewhat in the same time.
Yeah.
And I would guess, maybe I'm wrong, doesn't talk about it, that whether it was Satan or somebody else had gone to all 600 planets, maybe tried to get, or ones mm-hmm. they thought had a chance, mm-hmm. maybe not some that were
light,
to do that. So the timing here, it happened to be here, as you say, kind of, you know, is picturesque or sort of fits in. But mm-hmm. you know, who, what was, you know, what would have been like everywhere?
Yeah.
I mean, the timing was probably set And this might have been coincidental.
Yeah, I know. But see, remember, there are no coincidences in supremacy. See, that's the thing that's interesting about this. When you don't think of it in just our father-like terms, but you remember that it's a whole. And it's like coincidentally, I mean, all the things that weren't overtly part of the conspiracy seem to feed into the conspiracy. It's like remember when we read about the creative mother spirit ordering her angels, mm-hmm. you know? It's just like, no, don't get in the way of it. See, and you can see even the weather was joining in on the conspiracy, it seems. See, we have to appreciate how in the fullness of a system, there's going to be rebellions. And it's all going to be sort of optimum for those who can't penetrate through the sophistry to fall into the sophistry and sort of eliminate it from the system as rapidly as possible. Everything conspires so that there's as little delay. Everyone that's just is too clueless is going to go for it in short order. It's going to be out of the system in as quick as possible. Just notice that. That's not a... what would be the, you know, it's not an arbitrary coincidence. There aren't any arbitrary coincidences.
There are, but
you know, I mean, even like I've tried to point out, if you go all the way to the total finite, there's nothing arbitrary about a particular oxygen molecule and which oxygen molecules it's bouncing off of in front of me. I mean, all of that has some subtle wholeness. I mean, there isn't a single automaton that isn't subject to the influence of the whole. Yes, you know, there are many cases where it is so subtle, right, that for, you know, that it's virtually completely arbitrary, right? But you want to always remember that technically there is no such thing. Nothing is outside of the influence of the whole. And even if it's in the 500th decimal place, right, when you take that little 500th decimal place influence on that automaton and carry it all the way to the grand universe settled in light and life, it's meaningful, it's important. And of course, free will is also in play. But just remember, we'll get to this, there's an asterisk next to even the most free elements of your free will. I mean, you know, you either choose to conform to the system or you cease to exist, right? You aren't free in the sense that you can pick your own universe to live in or anything, right? I mean, there's only one cosmic system, and you know, you either conform to it, but in your original way, that system is looking for your original contribution from your absolutely unique personality, right? But you don't have an option of a system. And that's what rebellion is saying, no, I don't just want free will to contribute freely to the system. I want a different system. And then I'm going to contribute to that. It's like, well, you don't have that option. You're not sovereign over the external world. Right? That's a given. You conform to it or cease to exist. Right? All of your liberty, all of your true liberty is in law, right? Mm-hmm. Absolute law. Yep.
It seems kind of so simple it's almost silly. Because a system, no matter how big it appears to be, everyone who knows anything about the universe knows that's just a small part of the entire whole. I mean, Lucifer and Satan and Dalgastian knew all these things backwards and forwards.
But they convinced themselves otherwise. See, you know, I mean, that's, you know, it took it all the way to the first principle, you know, that says no, there isn't some wholeness that embodies the purpose. Right? They convinced themselves, you know, because remember, the individuality of the whole of the finite is so transcendent, so remote, that not even the ancients of days can have a direct communication with the Universal Mother. Right? The Universal Mother is one of those beings that's too transcendent even for them, and can only be given face and voice through the reflective image aids, like some other quite rarefied transcendent beings. See, so again, it boils down to, you know, it's at a higher level, if I can't see it, it doesn't exist. If I can't talk to it directly, you know, it doesn't exist. It's all just a conspiracy. There isn't really a universal mother talking through those reflective image aids. That's, you know, that's those foreign potentates and their whole scheme. You know, they're actually, you know, they're the guy behind the curtain, you know, pretending that there's this voice of the universal mother coming through the reflective image aids. It's really them faking it. Right? I mean, that's where they go. You know, they're rationalizing that it's, you know, that everything that they can't literally kick is a conspiracy, you know.
Well, that was in the manifesto.
Right? I mean, see, so, I'm trying to stress here, it's not just the universal father, right, that he can't see, can't kick, so therefore he doesn't exist. I mean, the more immediate problem is what you're bringing up, that there's no universal mother, that there isn't the whole of the finite and the individuality of that whole. And that no part, no matter how trivial in what it's up to, is subject to that wholeness, or it doesn't exist eventually. There is no other option. Yeah. That, see, remember, it's true and false liberty, right? The true and false is not, those aren't spirit words, those are wholeness words, right? Is your liberty put in the context of a whole or not, right? Lucifer and crew they have a proper spiritual consciousness initiated by the Father, right, that got them to recognize liberty, but they started thinking that there is no universal mother, that liberty doesn't perforce have to conform to the whole through her in the individuality of that whole. That's the problem. You know, that's why I say it appears from the Lucifer Manifesto that this is all just kind of a religious thing where you're rejecting the Universal Father. No, it's a philosophic war, not a religious war. Right? You're rejecting the whole. That's what philosophy is about. Religion is about the spirit parts. Philosophy is about the whole. That's the problem. Okay, so, well, I'm stressing that because we're going to get to that. I mean, that's a key element that they're going to try to get us to recognize here down the road a little bit.
Okay. Yeah,
I did. I read ahead. Just the one little thing that ought to catch your eye there. It's like if you were standing there, one would think you might feel a little twinge. The assembly was opened with the statement that Prince Caligashi was about to proclaim himself absolute sovereign of Urantia. It's like, seriously, dude? I mean, it sounds like some petty dictator in some third world country, you know? But what's the thread there? Right, I mean, he does. He has unquestioned, untempered sovereignty when the world is settled in light and life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He went there right away.
Right. See, again, he wants to jump right to light and life when he has the sovereignty. See, so, you know, when we read that, we think, seriously. I mean, that doesn't, wouldn't everyone just laugh at that? But you got to remember, you know, the whole point is, let's skip all the steps and just go right to when I'm sovereign. Enlightened life. That's what he's actually saying they want to do.
Okay? Wake up tomorrow.
Forget about all that conspiracy that's forcing you to do things painfully, slow, you know, just assailing your spiritual consciousness. That's what's in play. The spiritual consciousness that wants it now. Right? And that's the spirit candy. You say, now, and your whole objectivity shuts down if you have immature spiritual consciousness. You'll do anything if someone says you're going to do it now. That's exciting.
I got
to
go to the loop.
Okay.
Sometimes you have to.
I'm just teasing.
Yeah, but see, I'm trying to just point out, I mean, that Because it doesn't do us any good to stick this in the old wineskins or the old caricature. Right? You don't understand it. And you don't understand why it's relevant. Right? You've seen these suggestions. Right? They're on signs that are carried through the streets. Right? So,
well, this is an example of the end doesn't justify the means. In a way, what they were trying to.
Right. The means have meaning, right? Not just the end. See, and again, that's the, you know, the you have this will and the foresight of it to see the end that you got from your father. But your relationship with mother allows you to see the importance of what's in between. Okay? The way. That the way is not irrelevant. Okay.
The presentation of this astounding demand was followed by the masterly appeal of Van, chairman of the Supreme Council of Coordination. This distinguished administrator and able jurist branded the proposed course of Kalagastia as an act bordering on planetary rebellion and appealed to his conferees to abstain from all participation until an appeal could be taken to Lucifer, the system sovereign of Satania. And he won the support of the entire staff. Accordingly, appeal was taken to Jerusalem, and forthwith came back the orders designating Kalagastia as supreme sovereign on Urantia and commanding absolute and unquestioning allegiance to his mandates. And it was in reply to this amazing message that the noble Van made his memorable address of 7 hours length, in which he formally drew his indictment of Dalagastia, Kalagastia, and Lucifer as standing in contempt of the sovereignty of the universe of Nebadon, and he appealed to the Most Highs of Edentia for support and confirmation.
Okay.
Wow. yeah, he's going. Yeah, he thought, I'll appeal to Lucifer.
I'm gonna trump Kalagastia, and immediately he gets back from Lucifer. It's like, seriously, it's a system rebellion. and the two were in on it.
Not just a planet.
Yeah.
I'm in for the long haul.
This amazing message. You know,
careful what you volunteer for.
You can just see, you know, their mouths hanging open as this message comes back, you know, from Lucifer.
Yeah, can you imagine? Crestfallen.
Yeah. And you notice that the, you know, bringing in the little technical thing, you know, by declaring yourself absolute sovereign of Urantia, okay, technically, when you downstep absoluteness to the finite, you have supremacy. I mean, that's as much absoluteness as will come into direct relationship with the finite is supremacy. Right? See, so you see, he's technically the supreme sovereign, right? See, on Urantia. But you're still going to have, he's going to absolute and unquestioning allegiance. And again, remember, that's not out of the blue, right? I mean, what was the, in the Seven Commandments? You shall not disobey the Father's Son, the world's ruler, right? And that's a capital S Son in that, not a lowercase s Son, like us, right? You know, the first one is, you shall not fear nor serve any god but the Father of all, and then followed by that. You know, I mean, they've been teaching everyone that, I mean, effectively, he who sees the planetary prince sees God. That he is the direct voice of God to you. That you should not even slightly question. Right? Or you're in violation of our commandments that we're laying down. So again, see, this is the incredible trust he's given. I mean, now he's assumed the responsibility. He's not presuming. I mean, before the rebellion, he's assuming the responsibility of being the voice of God to this world. Effectively, God made manifest. Okay? In all of its, in all of God's truth. So, it's it's such a simple thing for them to corrupt that. I mean, all of the structure is there, and you just change the message in that structure. Okay, there's some of the other little points in there. You know, notice them calling Van's council, the Supreme Council, of coordination. And again, like I was just stressing, the whole point is, do you have enough innate relationship to the whole, through the individuality of the whole, that coordination, right, the whole, that you are sophistry-proof? Right? The 10 on his council, no matter what, are not going to fall for anything. But you notice that it's not like everyone else is just innately hopeless. Van can put this forth, like, oh, no, wait a minute, everyone. And they all agree, oh, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, this is pretty radical. We do need to get confirmation from the system sovereign on this. You know, not a one of them immediately said, oh, yeah, I'm all in, jumped in with both feet. Not a one of them of the 100. Okay, so that's important to notice. I mean, they've got Gerasim level integrity, you know, at least the minimum Gerasim level integrity. They don't all have the greater, like Van and crew, you know, and his 9, but just, you know, that's an important element that, you know, it reminds you, it isn't as, they weren't as hopeless as it might initially seem, you know.
I wonder what he said for 7 hours.
Yeah, so he tried to lay out that objective framework.
Philosophical war.
Right, yeah, I mean, you know, get people to have an integrity of a relationship to that framework instead of just fixating on the point. It's like, oh, the point is so beautiful, it's not worth stepping back and looking at the big picture. Let's just follow whatever the beautiful light says, you know, and follow it wherever it goes. And he's trying to get him to back up. He's like, no, back up, you know, put it in the big picture. And that takes a while, 2,000 pages in my lap to give you, you know, the minimum. Let's see. Okay, anything else there we need to? I think we got it all there. Yep. Keep going.
Meantime, the system circuits had been severed. Urantia was isolated. Every group of celestial life on the planet found itself suddenly and without warning isolated, utterly cut off from all outside counsel and advice.
Okay, so they set that one off by, you know, as a paragraph unto itself like that, because they want you to, you know, to think about the, you know, what that implies between the lines, just how precisely this is timed, right? I mean, Satan has come, you know, and told Caligastia, like, to the second, when Lucifer is going to announce on Gerasim. Because, you know, if you recall, as soon as Lucifer announces on Gerasim, the Melchizedek's immediately broadcast that there's a rebellion and the Most High's quarantine the system. You know, boom, they lock it down. All right, so, I mean, this is very precisely timed so that before the circuits are shut off, they can get the message back where Lucifer is saying, yep, he's got my full, right? And then it's shut off. See, so this is very precisely timed. And you wonder, like you were saying, maybe it wasn't as precisely timed on some of the worlds. But this one, yeah, like they said, where was that? I can't remember when they, oh yeah, there's this peculiar disdain upon Prince Caligastia because of this premeditated betrayal of trust, and like they said before. So there is an example where you can see that very tight. You know, and who knows? Maybe the lack of tight coordination like that, if you will, tight timing, synchronization on some of the worlds made it so that they didn't go into
think
rebellion
they
or something.
Weaker yeah. in their conversation yeah. with Satan, and you know, like there is today.
Yeah,
making the news to keep people on high. These guys are about to go into rebellion.
Now, remember who the bureaucrats are. These are all these very, very loyal seraphim. You don't have the. The deep state disloyal bureaucracy like you do in our bureaucracies.
Some life carriers.
But you know, and it would have been a very very off to the side, you know, whispering, you know. It would have been a very hush hush thing just between
just between those good guys.
You know, initially just between Satan and Caligastia, and then Caligastia took Dalagastia aside and, you know, got him all, you know, all precisely locked into it, and yeah.
But here again, as you've often said,
yeah.
the Mother Spirit would have known all about it.
Right, sir. I mean, well, and lots of beings. Remember, like they point out, I mean, lots of beings are watching what's going on in all their minds.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
know everything. But again, and they're going to stress that here in just a minute. They're not stopping in advance. Right? It's all, you know, it's all part of the evolutionary process. I mean, and that's where it, kind of a way to really express in short form what I was saying before. I mean, rebellion is part of the evolutionary system. You can't get anything settled in light and life on a grand scale without rebellions. Any more than you can make the grand universe settled in light and life, or even a local universe settled in light and life, say, without beings going to iniquity. You know, like we've pointed out many times, you can't make one supreme adjuster without iniquitous, you know, mortals. Right? They're indispensable to the evolutionary process. Okay? So it's, you know, that's, you know, when you, if you can back up enough that you can think about it in that objective context, you know, that this isn't some total outside. No, this is within the system. Rebellion is not coming from outside of the system. It's inherent in the system. It's an indispensable part of the evolutionary process.
Good timing, Gene.
Did you say you're the devil's advocate?
Yeah, he's going to play devil's advocate, to coin a phrase here.
The effect of shutting down communications mm-hmm. was, in effect, an isolating the system. If it's a good thing for the system to go into rebellion,
if it's good for the goose, why isn't it good for the gander? Yeah. Why is it good for other systems?
Yeah, why not let it spread to other systems?
The main reason is that you have this very foundational differential between systems. You know, literally, biologically, you can't procreate with beings from another local system. I mean, it's that foundational. Right, the Adam and Eve, or the material sons and daughters, you know, from two separate systems can't mate and procreate. Right? So it's that systemic, that foundational. The two are separate, and that has to be very definitively preserved, maintained. You can't allow this kind of a crosstalk between two local systems, right? I mean, they have a right, if you will, in that other local system, that adjoining local system, to not be polluted by this. They have their own flavor of rebellion predicated on their fundamentally different foundation that it has a right to manifest in its own way. If you want to press the point.
That even though it happens as part of evolution. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's not something they want to propagate.
Yeah, I mean, and it definitely isn't. Yeah, exactly. It isn't.
It happens, and that's part of the thing, but it's not something you want to You don't want to propagate sin, iniquity, evil. Kind of stuff.
Willy-nilly, yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because I wanted to make sure I qualified what I said before. I mean, it's not that every world has to experience rebellion, or every system has to experience rebellion. But, you know, there's, you know, you take a big enough scale, and, you know, there has to be some rebellion within that, you know, that scope of the finite.
The fact that you came from this planet, a rebellious planet, you know, trillions of years from now may have some effect on something that wouldn't happen if you hadn't. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's all kinds of things that, what do they say, there's thousands of things that positive come out of it already. Yeah, so I don't think, you got the point there, right?
So. Yeah. Well, yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to join Gene's devil's advocacy.
Yeah.
I mean,
we're losing people.
They're joining the rebellion left and right.
What do you want?
I mean, so why allow the circuits within the system? Why shut down the circuits within the system as well? I mean, along the lines of that, like, why not let it propagate to every world in the system?
Yeah, I mean, so you can begin to think about those details of if it's going to propagate, it's going to do it personally. You know, like Satan, for instance, is literally going to go from world to world and talk to the local planetary prince and try to get him on board. That again reminds you of, we're not trying to do this impersonal flash mob thing with our handheld devices in the local system, right? This is a real phenomenon, and it's given full opportunity to have that reality of expression, you know, or have that expression in full relationship to reality, I suppose I should say more precisely. It's even set up so that to properly do this, you have to do it in person. And, oh, coincidentally, you have no choice. Because you can't just sort of broadcast it, you know, on the loudspeakers. There's nothing fundamentally arbitrary or coincidental, like we were saying earlier about these things. Just, you know, notice that that's the case, and it's like, okay, so why? Why is that? And again, it just reminds you, it's fundamentally this very personal thing. And, and it's spread person to person.
And in a way, by hitting the mansion walls and the children areas, it did hit, you know, some of the other planets or people that had, you know, graduated from those other planets, whether they were actually rebellion happened or not on that planet.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was the horrible thing.
Yeah, definitely there's some horrible consequences, or people in the wrong place at the wrong time, so it appears, right? It's important to appreciate that it's a fundamentally philosophic, the wholeness of personality sort of a phenomenon, and the one thing that they are doing that's sort of immediately understandable about cutting off all of that intra-system linkages, they're not going to make the logistics any easier for them. I mean, the Most Highs are the integrous ceiling, you know, on these sorts of things, and they're going to see to it that it doesn't have the opportunity to. I don't know. I want to say this. They're not going to help. You know, they're in charge of those circuits, and they're not going to join the rebellion in helping them make the logistics of it easier. Okay, I mean, there's that basic issue. But that's not the important part. Like I say, I mean, that's why they did it. But you think about it more deeply, and it's like, but coincidentally, because they don't want to be participating, it actually ends up having to be spread in this, in the only way that it really can be spread, in this person-to-person fashion. So, again, that it's fascinating to think about how systemic the system is. It's like the whole thing is like this vast conspiracy. You do certain things for sort of circumscribed technical reasons, but you know not what you do in a bigger sense. It has all these consequences in the whole that it's like, coincidentally, that actually all works. But they weren't doing it sort of up front for that reason. We live in a vast conspiracy where every automaton of our body, you know, is part of a vast conspiracy of being within the whole.
I'm looking forward to reading Vans.
Yeah, me too.
Vans, yeah.
In a way, it seems like if the system circuits went down, shouldn't that be a clue?
That's what I was going to say. The celestial life knew.
No, so that's the foreign potentates. See, they're stepping in. Just like we told you, they're going to try to stop us. They're going to try to force us to slog through all those developmental epics instead of just going to right to light and life like we could if they wouldn't get in our way. And they're trying to thwart us.
So these guys, the superhumans on the planet, they're deliberating in the context of the circuits being cut up.
Yeah.
And are they aware of
it? Yeah, they're immediately aware. Right.
So in a way, that was kind of a thumbs up.
I mean, if there's any objectivity, it should be obvious to you that, I don't think Lucifer is doing what she should be doing here.
To your point.
But again, that's only if you respect the hierarchy, and one of the notions of the rebellion is there isn't a real hierarchy. They're just faking that. They're pretending there's a hierarchy, and putting themselves above you, and they have no right to be above you. It's an anarchy. It's all a plane. Right?
Well, and you can probably bet that throughout the broadcast, the rest of the universe knew that our system went into rebellion, even though they isolated it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's like they say back there in the Lucifer Rebellion papers, the Melchizedek's immediately broadcast it, and so everyone knows immediately.
Stay out of Mexico.
All right. Okay.
It's like Divinity right now.
Okay, so
can't go there.
That was a lot of time on that one tiny little paragraph. But right. So, the whole point of it is just that to note how precisely this is timed by Caligastia to fit into what's going on Gerasim. Right. This isn't some way down the road. Caligastia joins. No, I mean, this is exactly when it's starting on Gerasim. It's starting on our world, and that's an important point.
Caligastia formally proclaimed Caligastia, God of Urantia and supreme over all. With this proclamation before them, the issues were clearly drawn, and each group drew off by itself and began deliberations, discussions destined eventually to determine the fate of every superhuman personality on the planet.
Okay, so if absolute sovereign of Urantia wasn't enough, let's just God of Urantia, isn't everyone just going to roll their eyes and say you got to be kidding me at that point? No, I'll remind you again. I mean, that's effectively what they are evangelizing to every person on the planet, that that when you look at the prince of the world, you are looking at God. He is effectively the voice of God. It's as if God is standing right here in Dalmatia speaking to you, right? And so if he's virtually God, why not just recognize that he literally is, because there isn't any universal father after all, right? And so, it's just this, all it takes is this tiny little shadow of a hair's turning to take what's there and flip it all the way upside down like this, see? It's seductive, these sophistries, because not only do you have the spiritual candy that, you know, that pulls you in, but it's so subtle, right? And that, remember, that's what your cosmic intuitions are for, right? They, when you have a differential, if it's very subtle, the only way that you can separate one from the other is with a discrimination ability that an insight, a cosmic intuition has. That's what that word discriminate means. You know, is that the difference is subtle and slips right past most people who don't have insight. You know, you're just going on sight, they're identical. Right? The difference is too subtle for sight. Now that's what. So that's obviously what's in play here. Who has the insight and who doesn't? You know, not who's been sparked into spiritual consciousness by the Father and who hasn't. That's the old caricature, right? That it's about those who have been sparked into spiritual consciousness against those who are not, right? No. You know, everyone is sparked into spiritual consciousness by the Father. Everyone's been initiated. Who has the insight now, right, to discriminate?
I just wanted to say they didn't believe in the hierarchy, but in a way it's laughable because the hierarchy is so magnificent and powerful. They're like a speck of nothingness. I mean, the whole rebellion, in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, we're living through it, so in a way also it's horrifying. But it's really nothing in comparison.
Yeah. And
it does add to the supreme in a way, too.
And I guess the thing that we have to challenge ourselves, even if it feels like we have a very solid recognition of the majesty that is the hierarchy, you know, and we think that we have some visualization of the gradation of luminosity, as it were, as you go up the hierarchy. You know, if we actually could see a Lananandek, it's like, that is so much more brilliant than what I imagined the Universal Father was in my hierarchy.
Yeah.
I guess there isn't a hierarchy.
Right.
See, that's the trick.
Yeah.
It's just, we have no idea of just how much a Lananandek would meet all of our expectations of God.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, try to convince yourself that that's not God standing in front of you. If that Lananandek made himself visible, could you do it?
Bullets would go right through him.
He'd be so beyond your wildest dreams of the majesty of God.
Yeah. It would be interesting to see
one. Yeah. So I can see that point, but this is kind of like saying, you know, to declare a creature to be God is kind of saying, okay, deity doesn't exist, which is... No, that seems like a lot harder of a leap. Like, how do you even put the whole structure of creation together without deity underneath it?
Again, right, you have this breakdown of logical recognition. Yeah.
See, none of these guys had fused. You know, the thought adjusters weren't there.
Well, so not mentioning all the ones that have nothing to do with mortals and adjusters and stuff, but just all the celestials, too, you know, that he's speaking of that are, you know. It's like, you know, how can a Lananandek think that there can be a logical universe without deity? And that's the thing. I mean, for us, you know, that have really gotten into the revelation, it's like, how are you going to spin a story where it all makes sense if you throw out all those elements? And my answer is, yeah, you have no idea how clever a rationalizer these guys are. They can weave a story where they have... You know, what normally, you know, what logically deity does, they've come up with a rationalization scheme where you don't need it, and you still get the same end result.
Sounds familiar.
They're very clever, see?
That's where the Big Bang Theory came from.
Yeah, you can rationalize anything, right? And that's what we're doing. There's no limitations on that. That's not just because, you know, that's not for humans, in their ignorant view of things, you can rationalize anything. No, you can rationalize anything, even to Lenonidex and angels and whatnot. Right? I mean, there's always a rationalization scheme that can masquerade as reality.
To a point.
If you're clever enough. Right? Like I said, I mean, if you think that there's not a rationalization scheme for scumping, you need to get a better rationalizer. Yeah. You know, wait until a better rationalizer is born, and he'll come up with it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, political parties employ legions of people who sit there and just try to predict every future event and how they could rationalize it to suit their ends, so that when that event happens to occur, they're right there with the press release 2 seconds later, because they've already worked it out. If such and so happens, here's how we can spin it to our advantage. That's all they do all day long, you know, and that's how they got their job. Is there a better rationalizer than the run-of-the-mill person? Yeah, and they can rationalize just about anything. Okay, that's what we're in. Okay,
that's where it starts.
You know, and if you're not discriminating, you hear this very airtight rationale, and you go, "Well, yeah, I mean that's undeniable. What further proof do we need?" You know, and it's like, no, reason is the proof of science. Logic is the proof of philosophy. And you're dealing with a philosophic issue for which reason has no measure of validation. Only logical recognition, you know, can say whether this is valid or not. And that's what we forget. When you're dealing with the whole, reason is inadequate. Reason cannot say anything about the validity of the integrity of the whole. Okay, let's see. Before we go on, just make sure I haven't forgotten something. Let's see. We've got the God of Urantia. Let's see. Just that, you know, the issues were clearly drawn. See, there, you know, there's, it's there to be seen for he who has the eyes to see it. Now the question is, who has the requisite insight? Okay.
Seraphim and cherubim and other celestial beings were involved in the decisions of this bitter struggle, this long and sinful conflict. Many superhuman groups that chanced to be on Urantia at the time of its isolation were detained here and, like the seraphim and their associates, were compelled to choose between sin and righteousness, between the ways of Lucifer and the will of the unseen Father.
No Switzerland. No, everyone's compelled. Choose this day. Right? I mean, compelled's a pretty strong word to throw in there. So the unexpected kindergarten class that was just out on a field trip on our planet, you know, quote-unquote kindergarten class, okay, boom, that's it. You're not leaving the world. They're, you know, if they weren't an angel, you know, of some flavor, or a midwayer of some flavor. I mean, they're still here. They weren't allowed to leave. Yeah. If they chose rebellion. You know, remember we talked about that, you know, back there in the Lucifer Rebellion. Abaddon was the chief of staff of Caligastia. He followed his master into rebellion and has ever since acted as chief executive of the Urantia rebels. Remember how I pointed out? It's like, whoa, wait a minute. I thought all the rebels were taken off at Pentecost. Well, all the angels and midwares, but not all the other kinds of beings that might have been here, like these poor visitors that said, no, you're not getting on any transport, dude. You know, the day of reckoning has just come upon you unexpected. You have to choose between eternity and oblivion this day.
Well, the ones that chose eternity got off.
Right? Yeah, yeah. Eventually they would, yeah.
And you think, but you know, the ones that didn't, now that Michael's been here, you'd think they changed their mind. But,
well, that comes up. That comes up
okay,
in a little
I
bit.
Okay.
I
love how they, the
unseen father, because it makes your point kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Lucifer. Yeah. He's pretty visible. Killing Cain, telling Cain, that's all visible.
Yeah.
That's, and they're brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean,
how much more luminosity do you want?
Yeah. Van and his seven.
You already have to put on your eclipse goggles to even look at the Elanana deck. How much more luminosity do you want?
He's not that impressive, Van. It took him 7 hours to get that.
Yeah. 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 So, yeah, there's the point where they actually refer to these unfortunate, you might say, individuals that just happen to be here.
Why did they say
bitter storm?
Well, of the unseen
father. Because even though you can't see the Father, you can recognize the will if you have the requisite insight. I mean, again, this whole bit of, I can't see the Father, but I've taken delight in cultivating my third cosmic intuition to the point where it's as if I can. I mean, the insight is so... is engaging something so solidly, it's as if I'm grabbing him with my hands.
Like we can know what the Father would want. I can know what the Father would want me to do.
Mm-hmm. Right, and remember the technicality of will. Will is just potential. Right? To consecrate your will to the perfect will of God the Father, to consecrate your potential to the perfect potential of God the Father, you are recognizing you have a measure of this will from that source, so you have that connection. He has delegated part of the total will that initially was all in his hands to you, right? That fundamentally this will you have is the Father's will. It's where it came from. It's not your will. You aren't the source. He's the source. So obviously, what am I supposed to do with this will? I should be synchronizing it with what it, from the source it came from which it came. Yeah. Okay. Let's see, anything else there? No, I think I have to keep going.
For more than 7 years, this struggle continued, not until every personality concerned had made a final decision. Would or did the authorities of Videntia interfere or intervene? Not until then did Van and his loyal associates receive vindication and release from their prolonged anxiety and intolerable suspense.
Okay, they don't give you the specifics there, but eventually the Melchizedek receivers show up, right? It's like, okay, we weren't out there on a limb. Couple things that I've been hinting at already. That whole bit of not until every personality concerned had made a final decision, would or did the authorities of Videntia interfere or intervene, okay? Not only did they not interfere, but not even intervene. I mean, not even sort of step into the midst of it and present an alternative voice, right? Let alone literally interfering with what's going on. And that we kind of talked about how that respect. For this is part of the evolutionary process, right? It must be allowed to play out as part of the system. But don't just think about that historically. Remember again that it's only now that mortals on this world, as opposed to all of the celestials and stuff way back then, it's only now that the mortals on this world have enough spiritual consciousness that they can even have some tiny little measure of ability to join in on philosophic decisions in a philosophic war. Right? You know, why has no one interfered or intervened? Like, why hasn't Machiavelli and Melchizedek assumed planetary prince? Why hasn't Michael, returned again? Why hasn't a magisterial son shown up? Why hasn't someone they don't even reveal in the fifth epical revelation shown up? You know, you can, you know, whatever.
When do you want it?
Yeah. And we all know that the more spiritual you are, you want it now. But see, that's the truth there. Right? I mean, we have to be given a full chance to choose. Right? And we haven't had the ability to choose. I mean, we're so limitedly personal. Most of the time when we use the word choice, it's completely inappropriate. No, that's not a choice. That's a decision. but to actually get your personality in play, and literally choose to fall into the sophistry or not. So, we can talk about how much the sophistry that we're reading about in here can be seen in the streets and the newspapers and on TV today, and we can think of that in negative terms. It's like, oh, this is horrible. Everything's literally going to hell in a handbasket. But it's also a positive sign. That means it's not too far in the future when something significant is going to happen. Because, it only took a few years back then for those who could engage such questions to sort it out. So it might not be that long. Once it's actually in front of us, and basically everyone is feeling drawn to what's going on and has to choose, do I join in or say, no, I think I'm going to step over here. You guys, you go about your business there. Because I don't think that's going where I want to go. I'm not going to go along with that to get along. Okay, so that's it. That's where the truth really meets today. Keep it objective. When we talk about all this negative stuff, those are negative actualities, which are positive potentialities. Finally, for us, each of us, to have the opportunity to have something you can apply your insight to. That's one of the trickiest things when it's a material comforter and everything is sort of just surficial. Not a lot of things that you can apply your insight to. You don't need your insight for, all these rudimentary material things. Finally, something I can apply it to.
Am I going to buy this organic peach?
Am I going to think about peaches in a false spiritual dichotomy? Am I going to...
Here again, if everybody survives, and they have, you can't ask people to make a decision in something if they don't see both sides of the story. Yeah, so to speak.
See, that's a hope. Finally,
slowly.
But if you've been given eyes to see, to him who much is given is much expected. Now that you can see, you're expected
to look,
to choose, to look, to face the facts of it, and choose.
I think a lot of this probably end up happening on the mansion rules for a lot of people.
Sure. But in terms of things getting resolved for the planet, not thinking of it just in individual terms, yeah, right? But in planetary wide terms.
True.
let's see. And there was then the other thing. Yeah, the other thing is like I mentioned, why they pointed out the timing, how Caligash and Lucifer, literally have their watches synchronized, and boom, they go at the same time. Okay, remember, it was 2 years it took for the celestials to sort everything out on Gerasim and the satellites. Okay? It's not like we have dim-witted celestials here and it took them longer. No, it basically all gets sorted out in 2 years here as well, because it started at exactly the same time. So what's with the seven? Why were they in prolonged anxiety and intolerable suspense for another 5 years? Right, put two and two together. Oh, Gerasim must be 15 light years away. And it takes 5 years for the Melchizedeks to get here. Right? That's one of the between the lines. You know, here with the rebellion, it comes up again with the default. Right, where it's like it appears that it's a 5 year travel time.
Yeah.
So in other words, it's 15 light years from here to Gerasim.
Without the circuits, you're on snail mail.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole thing, like they're going to point out, it's finally they can breathe again when the Melchizedek receivers, you know, and the Veranda deck, you know, land on the planet. It took them 5 years to get here. I mean, yes, you're putting things between the lines, but seems like a pretty safe bet. If you're going to make a guess of how many light years Gerasim is away, this is what you've got to work with. That's your best guess, that it's 15 light years away. Yeah. Okay. So that's so now we got the section of those seven crucial years.
Three, the seven crucial years. The outbreak of rebellion on Jerusalem, the capital of Satania, was broadcast by the Melchizedek Council. The emergency Melchizedeks were immediately dispatched to Jerusalem, and Gabriel volunteered to act as the representative of the Creator Son, whose authority had been challenged. With this broadcast of the fact of rebellion in Satania, the system was isolated, quarantined from her sister systems. This was war in heaven, and the headquarters of Satania, and it spread to every planet in the local system.
Yep, there was quote unquote war in heaven. So, using that expression from the Book of Revelation, and notice instead of modifying what was between the quotes, they just took it literally. You know that phrase, "war in heaven," and they explained it parenthetically, you know, by heaven we mean the headquarters of Satania. That's the truth of that statement in Revelation. Remember how they pointed out many people have come up with rationalizations where effectively what they're calling heaven is the local system headquarters. Okay, and I was already using this information. See, there is the whole bit of as soon as Lucifer declares on Gerasim, the Melchizedeks send out the broadcast. The Most High's clamped down. You've got all these Melchizedeks that you're going to need to send to the rebellion worlds, right? So, and you're going to need a bunch of them on Gerasim and the satellites as well, so they immediately are sending Melchizedeks from reserves outside of the system.
Takes them a while to get there.
Yeah, and who knows how long it takes them to get there, Gabriel can move, but in terms of the Melchizedeks, they're going to have to travel however long. But remember, the Melchizedek receivers that came here, that were sent 2 years down the road, and then got here 5 years later. Those were already here in Satania. They were on Gerasim, those Melchizedeks that came here as the receivers. I mean, they've got lots and lots of Melchizedeks always just for such a contingency. They're not going to be caught off guard. They're not going to, some poor world is not going to have to wait, who knows how many years for Melchizedeks to come from Salvington or something, however many light years away that is, right? You need them on Gerasim, ready to go at a moment's notice. And if there was a rebellion world that was relatively close to Gerasim, right, it would have been 2 years plus just a little bit. Right? instead of plus 5 years. All right.
Spread to every planet.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's right. Because I was emphasizing that up front. Yeah, so
even though only 37.
See, that's where I wanted. That's what I was saying up front in my preface. And see, they actually poured out upon the whole system, like I was saying up front. That it's a think of it as a ubiquitous phenomenon in the local system. That it just spread. A little bit like our character Black Ooze, only it was black ooze with white paint on it, right? So that it looked like white,
Because that's an RSVP.
Okay, but it's it permeated. It was just like the force charge of space permeates, right? I mean, it permeated the whole system, every nook and cranny. So that every being, no matter where, was confronted with this issue. Hmm. All right, keep going.
On Urantia, 40 members of the corporal staff and 100 of 100, including Van, refused to join the insurrection. Many of the staff's human assistants, modified and otherwise, were also brave and noble defenders of Michael and his universe government. There was a terrible loss of personalities among seraphim and cherubim. Almost one half of the administrator and transition seraphim assigned to the planet joined their leader and Dalagastia in support of the cause of Lucifer. 40,119 of the primary midway creatures joined hands with Caligastia, but the remainder of these beings remained true to their trust.
Yeah, the minority remainder. So over 4/5 of the primary midwayers jumped in with both feet. Almost one half of seraphim, and who knows what the percentages are with the cherubim and the lesser unrevealed angels. I mean, obviously, terrible loss, and one might suspect that the fraction goes up as you go from seraphim to cherubim and from cherubim to the lesser angels. Maybe not, but it's going to be huge losses amongst all three groups. Let's see. Here you see that little parenthetical. We mentioned that way back when we were trying to understand kind of what was going on in Dalmatia. There aren't just the 100 modified Andonites that are assistants to the corporeal staff. You have some other just regular mortals, that are very much long-term assistants too. See, so they're mentioning them there, modified and otherwise. The interesting thing, we're also brave and noble defenders of Michael and his universe government. We often talk about how the fifth epical revelation is giving us so many things way ahead of the normal schedule of dispensations. The rebellion immediately brought in, they couldn't just do things up to the local system anymore. They had to start talking to people about the bigger picture, right? And not just up to the Most Highs, but see, bringing in the whole local universe. So it's not just now with the fifth epical revelation. It started 200,000 years ago that we started getting some revelation beyond the dispensational norm. So that's an interesting little sidelight. See, you could say a potentially positive benefit. They needed something bigger. The local system just spread throughout everybody. I mean, it just turned into a black ball. So you need something bigger, right? So that's in play. Let's see. Anything else there?
Overall, it's amazing how many people got beguiled.
Yeah, and they'll mention.
I mean, you'd think before you. you think, you know, angels and seraphim and cherubim will be a little bit wiser than this. After all, they've been around for a long time. They didn't just start here.
Yeah, and they're going to mention here shortly, you know, what the rub is, if you will. I mean, yeah, it's like, shouldn't they be wiser? Yes, but don't underestimate just how much you would decide that that Lindana Dect is God. Nothing that radiant could be anything but God. Remember, historically, when humans have seen an angel, you know, when an angel has been visualized to a human, they all thought it was God. Right? I mean, an angel was radiant enough that it exceeded their wildest imaginings for how radiant God would be. Right? So how much more radiant is a Lindana Dect? Yeah. Remember, this is not trivial. On Mount Hermon, Jesus said, I think I have enough insight that you could show me the luminosity and I won't fall for it. You know, do you think am I delusional? And they said, no, I think you can do it. We'll make them visible to you. And it was tough, remember? It took all of his spiritual strength to not be sucked in by the spiritual gravity of those beings. Yeah. You know, to a mortal, like, you know, even as a first circler Jesus, they were very seductive. It took all of his resistance to not have that spiritual gravity just suck him right in to their sophistries. Yeah. So you can't underestimate how compelling, how seductive, right, their spiritual luminosity is. All right.
The traitorous prince marshaled the disloyal midway creatures and other groups of rebel personalities and organized them to execute his bidding, while Van assembled the loyal midwayers and other faithful groups and began the great battle for the salvation of the planetary staff and other marooned celestial personalities.
There's the marooned ones again. The interesting thing here between the lines is how it does have a little bit of a kind of a literal war sort of a thing, you know, it's not quite an open field, you know, with the drummers and the lead and, you know, and the guys holding the flags, and they're going to march at each other and start shooting at each other. But you know, they immediately are sort of drawing a line and taking sides and kind of, you know, marshaling, you know, using terms like that. Because there are some physical things, like they're going to mention here in a moment, the Tree of Life. And so, I mean, there are physical issues that are in play. It isn't all just in everyone's, you know, minds that this is going on. So, they're giving us that little bit of kind of our caricature of these sorts of things, where they're all sort of just magical material, you know, stories that we tell. Let's see here. Let's see, anything else there? Saying things like the Great Battle. Keep going.
During the times of this struggle, the Loyalists dwelt in an unwalled and poorly protected settlement a few miles to the east of Dalmatia. But their dwellings were guarded day and night by the alert and ever-watchful loyal midway creatures, and they had possession of the priceless Tree of Life.
Yeah, so now I'll explain more about the Tree of Life in a second here, but they're reminding you of, you know, it's important to recognize that fundamentally it's a philosophic war, but there are all these outer life, even, you know, very basic material issues in play, like you have a wall and we don't now, because, you know, we've got to set ourselves apart. You've got your wonderful 40-foot-high wall to protect you from the hordes, and we're out here in little pup tents, exposed. Okay, they don't explain it a lot, but remember, even though it's much more difficult for primary midwayers to address material issues, material things, they can. So they are like putting forward whatever, you know, full exertion effort it takes on their part. You know, they have to literally cart this tree of life from point A to point B, and you know, dig it up and all that sort of stuff. And you know, and they're going to have to deal with hordes coming in with spears or whatever, you know. And so, there's some material issues in play.
So where were the rebels then?
They're all inside the, you know, the walled city.
Yeah, you wonder why the Midwares, they were the bad guys. Did they outnumber the good guys?
Yeah, right. There's,
but they didn't. They couldn't seem to. You
know. Yeah, 4-1. They outnumber them 4-1. You know, the rebel second primary Midwares. You know, the loyal primary Midwares.
They couldn't do anything. Couldn't conquer them, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and there's one little thing they throw in here in just a second I want to point out about that. You know, okay. It's like how literally material should we think about this war? There's a curious thing you'll see here in a moment.
If you're impressed by numbers, it's like...
Yeah.
You know, the greater number, the longer...
Yeah, I mean, you know, how does the run-of-the-mill human decide which side to pick? Well, I mean, how could this side be wrong? I mean, they've got the leaders, they've got the numbers,
the walled city.
I mean, doesn't it just speak for itself? Who's on the right side and who's on the wrong side here? Yeah. Right. I mean, courageous and independent. You know, you may be the only one against millions. It has to be a quality decision, not a quantity decision. But most people know nothing of quality. You know, we judge everything by quantity. You know, the numbers don't lie. You know, we have all kinds of expressions about it. You know,
fans stood alone. We have to stand alone too.
Yeah. Yes. Fundamentally, you do. Somewhere between now and you leaving the local system, you know, it's just you. You know, you don't get a pass out of the rebellion as part of a group. You and you alone have to stand there facing all of the sophistries and reject them as an individual, courageously and independently. Okay, let's see, what else is there? Oh, yeah, just the why are they ever watchful, loyal Midway creatures? Why do they make great night watchmen and day watchmen? And because they don't sleep. They can just stand there without blinking, watching.
Like legless.
Yeah. Upon the outbreak of rebellion, loyal cherubim and seraphim, with the aid of 3 faithful Midwayers, assumed the custody of the Tree of Life and permitted only the 40 loyalists of the staff and their associated modified mortals to partake of the fruit and leaves of this energy plant. There were 56 of these modified Andite associates of the staff. 16 of the Andanite attendants of the disloyal staff refusing to go into rebellion with their masters.
We'll talk a little bit more about the numbers there with the attendants, as we, you know, 'cause they bring that up in detail as we go forward here, but... couple things there. So notice that they made a point of mentioning the leaves. Right? That's a very seldom mentioned little issue, right? And it's almost always about the fruit, you know, that allows them to be plugged into the energy inputs from the master physical controllers. You know, and they never explain the leaves. They just hint that there's some truth to the expression in the Bible, you know, for the healing of the nations, quote unquote. See, apparently there's some sort of medical, you know, in a physical sense, usage with the leaves. So you're left to wonder, it's like, okay, why did they make a point of mentioning the leaves? Was there some literal injuries that we're dealing with here? I mean, if nothing else, you know, there might have been a bit of shoving and stuff when push came to shove, to coin a phrase, amongst the corporeal staff. So that's my sense, is that they mention the leaves there, and even though they don't explain how these are medically useful, that there, you know, there was some physicality that you needed the tree for.
It didn't take that many. I mean, 3 midwares and some cherubim
to
assume custody.
Yeah, and the midwares, of course, they're doing all the manhandling, you know, of it. So, I don't know. Did they get help from a master physical controller to unearth it? I don't know.
I mean is that, you know, obviously the numbers don't really, they can't, the other unloyal ones can't come in by number and kick the other guys out.
I admit to being a bit mystified and curious about the exact logistics of this. It's like, how do the 3 just say no to the 40,000? How do numbers not win? I don't know how to think about that. That's why I'm saying maybe the unspoken thing is, you know, the master physical controllers could be a lot of help in these sorts of things, right? Like I always say, if you had Machaventa set up a planetary headquarters now, a literal one, and we all decided that he was Satan and we should hit him with all of our artillery and nuclear weapons, or whatever, and blow up the planetary headquarters, the master physical controllers can just think all that stuff out of existence, right? it's trivial for them. We don't know how much the power beings might be involved in these doings. I don't know. You'll have to just speculate. They just don't give you any hints. But anyway, the leaves thing is an interesting point. Now, the very important thing that takes you out of the immediacy of this paragraph and out of the facts of those days is the very interesting coincidence of what fraction of the corporeal staff of the 100 choose loyalty and what fraction chooses disloyalty. Remember, there's 40 that remain loyal and 60 that join the rebellion. Okay? And if you're thinking a little bit mathematically, that should remind you of a very interesting parallel. You know, when you go all the way up to the end of paper 165 in part 4, Peter asks Jesus a question, and one of the things that Jesus says in his long response to Peter's question is the following: fiery trials are drawing near you. Yeah, the fiery trials that we're going through here 200,000 years ago in our story. I have a baptism to be baptized with, says Jesus. Right. Baptism, fire. Right. Facing the rebellion. I have a baptism to be baptized with. You do the whole water shtick. Okay, I've got a baptism for you. And I am on watch until this is accomplished. Right? Until the fiery trial is upon you. You preach peace on earth, but my mission will not bring peace in the material affairs of men, not for a time at least. Yeah, of course, we eventually get to light and life. Yeah, but in the immediate effects of the Spirit of Truth poured out upon all flesh, right, division can only be the result where 2 members of a family believe in me and 3 members reject this gospel. Friends, relatives, and loved ones are destined to be set against each other by the gospel you preach. Right? And if that isn't the result of the gospel you preach, you're not preaching the true gospel. If it's all sunshine and lollipops, you're not preaching the gospel. Right? And look at the numbers.
Yeah,
40. Coincidentally, 40%, right? Positive, 60% negative, the exact same. Jesus uses the 40-60 percentage. Right? The lesser number remain loyal. And so think about, it's like, well, yeah, but wouldn't the 56-44 with the modified Andonites be more relevant to us? They have adjusters, you know, helping them and all that like we do. Well, you do you? Remember, it's sad to record that so few persons on your ranch to take delight in cultivating. Right? I mean, the appropriate number for us is the corporeal staff that don't have adjusters, because effectively we don't in many ways. You know, especially when push comes to shove and whether or not you have, you know, a relationship to the other parent. If you have the wisdom, the requisite wisdom, right? Not just a relationship to being initiated by the father and that father fragment, right? Well, so Jesus is saying, yeah, that's the actual percentage that's in play. When he looses the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword, right? The spirit of truth, right? It's a 40-60. And a family of five, two yes, two thumbs up, three thumbs down. Yep.
Well, the thing that's remarkable to me is that every one of the Andonites paired with the loyal staff members, went with their loyal staff members, everyone.
Yeah.
Without a break. 16 failed to go with their disloyal staff member into rebellion.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine the sadness they felt?
Yeah.
To break this bond?
Yeah. 200,000 years, right? They're paired one-to-one, right? You know, one modified Andonite to one corporeal staff, yeah. And those 16 that looked, you know, their 200,000, or 300,000-year-old, I mean, 300,000-year-old companion, right, in the face, and said, I'm sorry, but you're off in la-la land, dude. You've gone off the reservation here. I mean, and... You know, and they're Andonite, right? Yes, they're modified, and yes, there's been 300,000 years of some genetic mutation, and they're, you know, they're augmented, but still, you know, it's basically a Homo erectus, you know, looking at a Gerasim citizen and seeing right through him. Pretty amazing stuff. Yeah, and the sadness, like you're saying, just the sadness, this doesn't even, I mean, the anguish, the gut-wrenching anguish those you know, individuals must have felt to turn their back on their closest friend. I mean, this 300,000-year intimate relationship with this individual, right? We can't even imagine what that's like, right? We get all wrought up with someone we've known for a few years if we have to part ways. There's some amazing stories there of pain and anguish and incredible fortitude, and you know it's quite the story that could be told. But anyway, I wanted to take this opportunity here to just, you know, make sure you recognize how Jesus held up just how profound the truth is that's flowing through these facts of 40-60 here. That's That's the what's most relevant to you. So, you know, don't be too tempted to identify with Amidon. You know, yes, there's a lot to hold up there, but Jesus says no. The relevant percentage is 40-60. I like the staff, because you just, you know, you're not like those 300,000 years into it Andonite, modified Andonites. Think about what an incredible relationship to their adjusters they had. Right? I mean, you're going, why haven't they all fused? Yeah, see, obviously, they're not being allowed to fuse. Right? Yeah, but they've, you know, they've made all kinds of progress in their circle development.
Especially over
300,000
years.
Right, over 300,000 years. Right? Think of this. You know, all of that, you know, intimate tutelage, you know, by the prince's staff and everyone. So, yeah, anyway, very interesting. It's right there, the Jesus' story about the two and the three in the family, you know. And you've got this family, right? These Andonites and the corporeal staff, they're a family, just like Jesus was talking about there. All right.
Chris,
yep.
I think you've addressed this, but David Jones is asking specifically about a question about Van. Mm-hmm. One wonders why the rebels did not launch attacks either themselves or instigate other tribes to demolish Van, etc. How indestructible is Van?
Well, see, again, I mean, Van is not indestructible. So, yeah, and that's what I was pointing out. You're left to just kind of speculate how much material warfare is going on with this. You know, remember what happened in the wake of the default. Right, immediately they poured out of the garden and killed every Noddite, you know, that they could find. Right, it was physical war. So, yeah, you're left to just speculate. I mean, how much, you know, physicality is there here, and if so, how is it being mitigated or militated against? You know, how much the, like I was saying, do the power beings, are they helping out? I don't know. I mean, you're left to just speculate. But it probably got pretty ugly. You know, if not between, say, like he's pointing out, between kind of just mortals and any of the either camp of the staff. Just between mortals out there all around Dalmatia, you know, that, you know, they're picking sides, right? They might have a very strong tendency to go to battle against each other, right? Yep.
He just had another question. Mm-hmm. And I think he's fast-forwarding to current times.
Mm-hmm.
If everyone is automatically saved, what difference does it make what one decides on the question before us now about the rebellion?
Well, I mean, all of us are, you know, get to the first mansion world, but all of us don't get to fusion. We're mortal until we fuse. So, you know, there is definitely an individual point in play of, you know, you need to decide if you're going to go the way of the rebellion or not before you leave the local system. So that's that individual issue. But certainly, you know, it's very important to not just treat it as an individual issue, like I keep stressing. I mean, we all know that the big thing about the rebellion was not, you know, how many or which individuals joined the rebellion. It's the fact that we didn't have civilizational uplifters anymore, you know, and we're all just groping around in the dark for the last 200,000 years. You know, it's that collective consequence of the rebellion, you know, that is certainly the big thing that impacts the evolution of civilization going forward from 200,000 years ago. You know, and that's what they focus on. You know, as soon as we're done with this paper, they don't go into a whole series of papers about individual salvation issues. Right. They go into the story of the evolution of civilization. Right. So, I mean, for the Urantia book, that's the, you know, the immediate thing in play. But don't ever forget that, you know, you're not just mortal here, you're mortal from here until you fuse.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you gotta think about that that salvation issue, if you will, you know, in an extended context. I mean, everyone's going to get off the planet, basically, because you all have a soul by grace. So you don't have that issue of not being able to get off the planet because you don't have a soul, because you didn't get an adjuster. But that just gets you to the first mansion world. Okay.
Throughout the 7 crucial years of the Caligaster Rebellion, Van was wholly devoted to the work of ministry to his loyal army of men, midwares, and angels. Spiritual insight and moral steadfastness, which enabled Van to maintain such an unshakable attitude of loyalty to the universe government, was the product of clear thinking, wise reasoning, logical judgment, sincere motivation, unselfish purpose, intelligent loyalty, experiential memory, disciplined character, and the unquestioning dedication of his personality to the doing of the will of the Father in paradise.
It's like, yes, there's the unquestioning dedication of his personality to the doing of the will of the Father in paradise. But you need a lot more than just that. Because if you have just that, okay, unquestioning dedication of his personality to doing the will of the Father in paradise, and the unquestionable voice of the Father in paradise is Caligastia. I see, if all you have is that father instinct, if you will, right, you follow him wherever. And you need more than that. Right? Especially when you've been told by all the established authorities that he is the voice of God. You know, turn off your brain and just go with it. Right? He's taught as being, you know, like a mullah, right? The voice of God. You know, that's the way he's presented. You know, and so you're going to need all that other stuff that comes from the other parent, and taking delight in cultivating, achieving some self-mastery. And you notice all the favorable conditions there, like loyal and humble and sincere and whatnot, right?
Of the experiential memory.
Yeah, and that's a handy thing, of course. He did have a whole bunch of memory of, you know, all the time up to Jerusalem. Now, that came in handy, too. But, you know, just they sum it up in the beginning, the spiritual insight and moral steadfastness. And if you want to just kind of summarize it, see that, you know, that insight, you have that moral steadfastness, you know, in the holistic sense of using the word moral, you have this wholeness. Right, and the definitive insight that goes with it, and so you see through the sophistry.
Duty to the cosmos.
Yeah. Yeah.
So always ministering to these guys, amazing.
Yeah. So, So, you know, he, even though down inside he's like prolonged anxiety and intolerable suspense, or okay, he's putting on a strong face, right? He's resolute, you know, he puts forward a resolute face, and he's trying not to look like there's any question marks there as he's talking to everyone. But he's like, oh, I sure do wish I'd get a little validation. All right. Because he, you know, he's humble. He's, you know, he knows he can't let this become an instigator of pride either. It's like, whoa, I'm standing up against, you know, the planetary prince and everyone. See, this could go to spiritual pride on a dime if he's not cautious. So he's trying to remain humble, which means it'd be really handy to get some established authority on high come down and say, yep, man, you're spot on. All right.
Chris?
Yep.
The Caligaster kind of cuts a little slack for us that 7 years was considered intolerable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because we think that at times, and yet we have the bigger perspective that it's just an instant in time.
It is.
So
yep.
It kind of validates
yep.
our position.
Yeah. 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 There's is just as long, you know. Having that tension is not bad. Just don't let it be the final say.
Yeah,
everything. Yep. All right. Okay. Let's see. I think we got everything there. Yep. Keep going.
This 7 years of waiting was a time of heart searching and soul discipline. Such crises.
Crises.
It's hyphenated in my book.
Uh-oh.
In the affairs of the universe demonstrate the tremendous influence of mind as a factor in spiritual choosing. Education, training, and experience are factors in most of the vital decisions of all evolutionary moral creatures. But it is entirely possible for the indwelling spirit to make direct contact with the decision-determining powers of the human personality so as to empower the fully consecrated will of the creature to perform amazing acts of loyalty, devotion to the will and the way of the Father in Paradise. And this is just what occurred in the experience of Amidon, the modified human associate of Van.
Okay, before we deal with the modified ones there in the latter part of this paragraph, just note at the very beginning, they're transitioning from what they said before and summing it up. All right, this 7 years of waiting was a time of heart searching and soul discipline. All right, and by heart we mean the temple within, right? The upper domain in the hourglass analogy. Okay, so you're not it's genuine heart searching. It's not asking how does this make me feel. That's not the question in play, right? Trying to figure out how what's being said makes you feel and going with that feeling as the decider of which camp to join. See, such crises in the affairs of a universe demonstrate the tremendous influence of mind as a factor in spiritual choosing. See, that's, as again, there's two consecrations you need to be working on. Not just the initiating consecration of consecrating your will to the perfect will of God the Father. You need to be consecrating your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. Right? Because why did 60% go with Kalagastia? It's not because they didn't have very definitive powers of spiritual choosing initiated by the Universal Father that, sadly they're ultimately rejecting, but nonetheless initiated by their relationship to the Universal Father. Right, it's the mind issue. It's the relationship to the Mother issue. That's what was inadequate. That's what fell short. And so that's... that's what the sad to record is about. Right? And this adds a whole new dimension to the sadness of the author saying it's sad to record. He's projecting forward. When the fiery trial is fully manifest, it's sad how many are going to have an unfortunate choice because they're going to lack the requisite wise judgment. So from that, see, pointing out the basic issue with the corporeal staff and the 40-60, then they address the question, well, why wasn't it exactly 40-60 for the modified Andonites? Why did 16 of them break the, what their leaders, were suggesting they do? The difference is the adjuster, as they're pointing out. And like I said, don't you know, the adjuster is a significant influence in them because they've got 300,000 years of cosmic growth, you know, circle development under their belts. Okay, so yeah, they're basically the genuine Homo erectus, not the backmated Homo erectus, they're the pure Homo erectus. But 300,000 years, okay, that'll make up for a lowly start. Yeah,
even I might get there.
Yeah, even I might get there in 300,000 years, you know, from at least a sixth circler. Yeah, so that's their point. That's why, but it only got 16 more.
Yeah.
Right? Even with what they say there. Yeah, but it is entirely possible for the indwelling spirit to make direct contact with the decision-determining powers of the human personality so as to empower the fully consecrated will of the creature to perform amazing acts of loyal devotion. 16. Only 16.
Out of, what was that?
Well, there was 100 that were qualified the same way.
16 out of the 60.
16, okay.
See? Right, there's, you know. So, yeah. So, yes, I mean, it a little goes a long way, but, you know, but then that kind of just brings it back around. Yeah, we are, even after 300,000 years, the relationship is still tentative. Okay? So it just should bring in a lot of humility about how first circularly you are, right? How much like a first circler you are. You know, or whether or not you are a first circler or even a third circler. It's, you know, remember the thing about, oh, wow, the planet gets to light and life. Now, finally, more mortals are getting the third circular in their lifetime. You're going, seriously, it's light and life. It's a civilization we can't even remotely imagine. It's so divine. And they're living for 500 years. They have perfect genetics. And they're getting the third circular in their lifetime.
And Jesus made it the first in 30 years. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and that reminds you just how experienced his adjuster was.
Wow.
Yeah. That's a seriously helpful adjuster. But how many mortals had to go to iniquity to get that experienced adjuster so that Jesus could benefit? See, Jesus getting to first circular, he's standing upon a foundation of iniquity, the consequences of iniquity. Right, as those mortals went to iniquity, their adjuster went to supremacy. Right. So. Yeah. It. Yeah. It just all. It's. Notice how it's in contrast to what Jesus said. You preach peace on earth. I'll extend that. You preach that the universe is just one vast, fuzzy, sunshine and lollipops place. No, the universe is a little more rugged than that. Okay.
Consecration must be, it's so daunting, I can't even imagine it.
Yeah.
Full consecration. And
the more you recognize how daunting it is to have this level of consecration of mind, the more you should rise up from prayer to thanksgiving. Get up above prayer to thanksgiving for the grace that you live in. See, look how difficult it actually is to get the first circular. Okay? You should just wake up every day wanting to just, you know, give thanksgiving the whole day for the grace that is bestowed upon you. Right? That you don't have to face such ruggedness as a little child. Right? That by grace, you can just putz along like we do, you know, and don't have to, well, you got to do the absolute thing tomorrow. Terry Lo Consolo. You know, You don't get the luxury of being a child anymore. You got to be a full adult tomorrow. You know, there's grace that buffers us from some of that ruggedness. But eventually we mature into adults and we have to face the rugged facts of reality. Okay, let's get a little bit more about Amidon.
Amidon is the outstanding human hero of the Lucifer Rebellion. This male descendant of Andon and Fanta was one of the 100 who contributed life plasm to the prince's staff. And ever since that event, he had been attached to Van as his associate and human assistant. Amidon elected to stand with his chief throughout the long and trying struggle. And it was an inspiring sight to behold this child of the evolutionary races standing unmoved by the sophistries of Dalagastia, while throughout the 7-year struggle, he and his loyal associates resisted with unyielding fortitude all of the deceptive teachings of the brilliant Kalagastia.
Yeah. Fallacies are deceptive. Sophistries are also seductive. And so they're reminding you of, you know, both elements there. And, you know, why is it so glorious? You know, they said it. To behold not this adult of the evolutionary races, 300,000 years old, you'd think they'd say adult, but no, child. Right, that's the majesty of it, you know, that even as effectively a child, because he took enough delight in cultivating, supplying the favorable conditions, and was grown adequately, even that relatively little child could literally stand against the sophistries of Dalagastia. You know, and there's nothing subtle about it. I mean, Dalagastia's in his face. You can see him talking right at him, right? Jiggling air molecules, if it doesn't work, quote unquote. Not literally, you know, but I mean, it's that, you know, it's a literal engagement.
He came outside the wall.
Yeah. I mean, it's a mind-to-mind linkage, you know, in terms of communication. Yeah, you know? But yeah, right? They're modified because of their modifications.
Yeah. He was taking a tree of life, remember?
Yeah, I mean, the modified Andonites. You know, I mean, we don't know exactly if right from the get-go they could, but I mean, you can certainly speculate that over time. And I mean, they're you know, using the tree of life, and you know, they're basically like material sons and daughters, right, who can see all of the lower beings.
Well, they wouldn't have said brilliant. I mean,
yeah. So, yeah, I mean, he's engaging him very much face-to-face. This isn't just an abstraction to Amidon. He has to, you know, it's not unlike what Jesus had to face on Mount Hermon. Yeah. And there you see, like I pointed out, it's, you know, yeah, you might have wondered till they make it specific here. It's a one-to-one pairing. You know, the 100 modified are paired up with 100 original in a literal, you know, one-to-one, you know, unchanging over the whole time. So Amidon was only with Van for that 300,000 years. Let's see, anything else we want to point out there? Nope, keep going.
Kalagastia, with a maximum of intelligence and a vast experience of universe affairs, went astray, embraced sin. Amidon, with a minimum of intelligence and utterly devoid of universe experience, remained steadfast in the service of the universe and in loyalty to his associate. Van utilized both mind and spirit in a magnificent and effective combination of intellectual determination and spiritual insight, thereby achieving an experiential level of personality realization of the highest attainable order. Mind and spirit, when fully united, are potential for the creation of superhuman values, even Marantia realities.
Wow. Let's deal with that last part first, just to stress that. Make sure that you don't get too far off in, you know, in interpreting that. See, intellectual determination and spiritual insight. Right? Just the mind you have, plus your encirclement in the Holy Spirit. That's fundamentally all you need. Yeah, I mean, if you can bring in spirit of truth, you know, any influence in thought or gesture, okay, wonderful. Right? That just it helps. But it's not necessary. The spirit of truth and the thought of gesture are not necessary. The Holy Spirit is plenty. Allow that spirit ministry to genuinely influence your mind. And that'll give you all of the steadfastness that you need. That spirit insight, that spiritual insight, combined with your agitant mind, is a mighty force against sophistry. Notice how they point out the contrast between Kalagash and Amidon, and it's like, you know, but Van, of course, you know, he had some additional things that Amidon didn't have. And there's very few examples of a more minimum of intelligence, remember, because he's Andonite. You know, on a normal world, there isn't that, intelligence is never that minimum. You know, that pre-Sangic sort of intelligence like that. So, I mean, he really stands for the whole super universe as this incredible contrast that even when you make more will creatures that far down, they can stand unmoved. You know? So, I mean, if Amidon can do it, think about the sheepish grins on the angels in the wake of, you know, them joining the rebellion without even thinking about it, and then learning about Amidon, it's like, whoa, okay. What was I thinking? Maybe I need to be a little bit more present, a little less just allowing myself to be pulled along by my spiritual nose ring, by someone, you know, who tweaks my spiritual fancy. All right.
There is no end to the recital of the stirring events of these tragic days, but at last the final decision of the last personality was made, and then, but only then, did a Most High of Edentia arrive with the emergency Melchizedek's to seize authority on Urantia. The Kalagastia panoramic reign records on Jerusalem were obliterated, and the probationary era of planetary rehabilitation was inaugurated.
Yeah, and we just made sure we clarified, right, that technically, everyone that had the ability to figure out what was going on and genuinely engage it, figured out, you know, in relatively short order. It didn't take the full 7 years. And that's what, you know, the fact that it's like, well, okay, everyone has, you know, has decided here where are, you know, that's what, you know, why it was such a prolonged anxiety and an intolerable suspense. You know, if everything was still very dynamic throughout the whole 7 years, you know, they wouldn't be going, okay, we're ready anytime now. Where's the Veronidek and the Melchizedek? So just because you could, you know, unless you think about it all together, you could, you know, you could think that, you know, that it took the whole 7 years, and that you wouldn't appreciate that 5 years giving you the hint about the travel time. Okay. All right. We talked about this some before, the whole bit about the panoramic rain records being obliterated and how stunning that is. It was a few sessions ago that came up. I can't remember, but prior in a preceding session, a previous session, we talked about that.
It's a strange way to put it.
Yeah, and it's just so sweeping. It seems like, well, what about history? I mean, don't we? Well, yeah, they did. They didn't. They didn't erase. They didn't erase it from all the history books and stuff. It's just, you know, it's not there in the reign records, and it leads you to think about, it's like, oh, so the reign records must be something more than just sort of a presentation of the facts, kind of in museum fashion. It must be more a presentation of the truth, and you know, and saying, no, that's not truth, that's error. And so it will not have a place in the panorama.
So it kind of makes pulling down the statues valid.
Right, and see, we can all think about, well, valid or invalid. You can rationalize anything, be careful here. But as we wrestle with our history and stuff, yeah, these are, you know, we don't want to, I mean, like I mentioned, we talked about it before, it's not like all the details of Caligastia's reign aren't in the textbooks at that special college that the Melchizedeks run about the rebellion. Right? Every detail is in those textbooks.
So just the records on Jerusalem?
Because those, you know, if you erase all the history, you know, you're destined to repeat it. We all know that bit about, you know, he who knows not their history is destined to repeat it. Right? It's just that they're not going to present it as a shining example of truth. Okay?
Wasn't there it was in that recital about some structural portion of a promenade or something? It was erased.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the physical feature of it.
Yeah, and you see, we're struggling because, we're thinking way too simplistically about what these records are. That's why I'm suggesting maybe to not try to think about it factually, which I'm pretty sure we can't. But to just go the truth that when you're watching the doings of someone who's kind of on, you know, kind of way out there in the bell curve of Lenonidex, you know, and it might seem like error, but you know that eventually the fact that it's truth is going to come out. But see, when this happened, no, it's not one day recognizable truth. It's error. It's just error. You know, and the record of the error is erased, as opposed to us thinking about it factually. I think that's probably the way to try to understand it in some way. Anything else there before we wrap up? I wanted to mention, it's not often that you get, in both mentioned, did a Most High Evidentia arrive with the emergency Melchizedeks? You know, so often we think of there's just these 12 Melchizedek receivers for all that time. No, the Veronidek has been here the whole time as well. You know, don't ever forget about, because he's, you know, in terms of ruling in the kingdoms of men, he's the individual, not the Melchizedeks, not the 12 Melchizedeks. Right?
Still here.
Yeah. Right? He's the key individual. For a lot of the stuff that we're most immediately interested in, the kingdoms of men. Right, it's that Veronidek, not all those Melchizedeks, or the resident governor general now, and those sorts of things. We'll just keep chugging on with it next time here. Let's take a moment, everyone.